Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP, hosted by Eli Mazur. Louis Carboneau is one of the world's top patent brokers, who has brokered over 4,500 patents. He was once the head of licensing at Microsoft before starting his own patent brokerage firm, Tangible IP. At that time, it was the Wild West of patent brokering. There were days of billion-dollar patent deals. Many were eager to join in on this action. But after the gold rush died down and many got out, Louis stuck with it. On this episode, Eli and Louis talk about that history, how patent transactions get done, what makes patents valuable today, and how Apple survived because of a patent deal. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution.
Thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure.
The first question that I like to start with is, do you remember when you first learned about patents, and did you have any thoughts about the role they played?
When I first learned about patents, that was back in law school. Yeah, I mean, this was obviously something when you take your first IP class, you don't know what you're doing. It's usually an elective class, and you're just trying to fill in your credits for the semester. So I was going into this completely oblivious to the fact that, you know, patents, copyrights, trademarks were all, you know, different rights, IP rights that you could have. And so, you know, I grew up in Montreal, Quebec. So, you know, it's a very different environment as far as IP is concerned than what you have in the U.S. You know, I always tell people in Canada, you know, IP is a recreational sport, and in the U.S. it's a full contact sport, you know, to keep the hockey analogy. So it was quite a discovery. And so I kind of stumbled into this and really liked the class. And the teacher, the IP teacher, was a practicing lawyer at a local law firm, actually asked me later on to come and help them update I think they were editing a trademark, treaties every year. So they had to basically photocopy thousands of pages to update, you know, the cases and all this. So he gave me a part-time job because I asked too many questions in class. And that's how I kind of, you know, worked. My first job was actually with an IP firm, you know, when I was probably 19 or 20 years old.
Eventually you joined Microsoft in 1998. Was that in Canada or in the U.S.?
Well, actually, a little bit of both. I joined Microsoft, so I was in private practice as a patent litigator in Canada up to 95, and then Microsoft had just made its first large, you know, foreign acquisition when they bought a company called Softimage in 1995, which was a computer graphics company that came to fame by animating the first dinosaurs in the initial Jurassic Park movie. And Nathan Myhrvold, who was the then CTO of Microsoft and a big fan of dinosaur bones, because he was doing a lot of searches himself, you know, going to the Badlands area, and he was into dinosaurs. When he saw the dinosaurs animated by Softimage authoring tools, he just went nuts and said, we need to buy this company, which frankly was probably not the best business case. But lo and behold, they bought Softimage in 95. And then after the dust settled, they were looking for an IP lawyer to become the GC of the subsidiary. And that's how I started with Microsoft. So I actually started as a, part of the legal department, which was obviously directed from Redmond. I was the only headcount in the whole company in Montreal that actually reported to someone in Seattle, in Redmond, near Seattle, at the headquarters. But I was, you know, based in Montreal for 3 years. And then, you know, by the time I had kind of gone around the garden, you know, they offered me a promotion with a one-way ticket in 98 to go to Seattle to continue to work with them at the headquarters.
And obviously, we'll talk about Nathan Myhrvold. He's a founder, I guess, some people might say, the infamous founder of Intellectual Ventures. So that's an interesting connection. Mm-hmm. I guess he's responsible for bringing you to America in some ways. I guess, can you give us a sense of what Microsoft was at the time? Obviously, 1998 was, you know, when DOJ filed this antitrust lawsuit. It was right before the dot-com bubble burst. I guess, what was it like being part of that company at that time?
Yeah, no, it's a great question because Microsoft was a very different company. Microsoft, if you go back to the late 90s, Microsoft was at the top of the world. You know, if you work for Microsoft, people were just looking at you differently. It was really very cool to be with Microsoft. This was the kind of the most admired company in the world at that time. You know, there was no Google. The Apple was just a ghost of itself at that time. You know, actually, you know, people don't realize Microsoft kind of saved Apple from pretty much going bankrupt in 98, I believe, when we in the disguise of a patent cross-licensing deal, we essentially gave Apple, I think, $500 million in cash so they could last a little bit longer. And right after that, Steve Jobs came back. And, you know, the goal was really to keep at least one competitor, alive so that the DOJ would not be on our back too early, because otherwise, if Apple was going away, Microsoft was becoming not only the de facto monopoly, but the only operating system left. So we couldn't just hand money out like this. So we actually did a patent cross licensing deal with Apple, where we decided to pay them a pretty handsome fee for the licensing. You cross-license, obviously, all your portfolio, but, you know, there's always someone writing a check to the other party. And at that time, although we had, you know, a decent amount of patents, you know, we end up writing a big check, which was in part predicated by the fact that we wanted Apple to, you know, stay around. And that was actually probably the first thing. No, I think Steve Jobs was just back then, and that was his first move, was to call Bill Gates and say, let's do a deal so we can get some fresh cash, you know, to help the company. And then the rest is history. Apple then just kind of, you know, took off when Jobs was back. So, but it was a very different company, much smaller, obviously. I think the legal department, I think they were just about maybe 20 lawyers total. And they, you know, when I left, I think they were over 200. So it grew very, very fast after that. And then, yeah, we went into DOJ mode in 2000, and then a lot of things changed. You know, we lost some of our swagger, and, you know, we had to have a much more, I would say, accommodating stance with our partners, whereas historically, you know, it was very easy to do deals when you were at Microsoft. You just had to say no, and the other guys would cave in, right? That was not the fact after 2000. So, and another company started getting bigger, and there was a bit more of an even playing field. But it was a very tough period when we were in the midst of the DOJ, and everybody hated us, and, you know, it was hard to find friends around.
That's interesting about Apple, that you could, especially in light of their more recent history, is that they basically survived because they were able to monetize their patent portfolio. It seems
in part. I mean, obviously, you know, I don't think it's being documented like this, and, you know, people who were involved will probably, you know, say that that's not the case, but that's kind of our understanding, you know, internally, that, you know, part of that was really to help them stay around. That was the first deal that Jobs did, you know, when he came back to Apple. So yes, it's a little bit ironic given Apple's stance with patents nowadays, that this is what kind of kept them alive.
So I mean, your title eventually was Microsoft General Manager of IP Licensing. I guess my question was your role licensing patents? And I guess, why was Microsoft even interested in doing that? Obviously, their core is selling software and services. Why were they even interested in, I guess, spending their time and energies into licensing their IP?
Yeah. Well, as you know, there's licensing and licensing. So, you know, when we told, when we were telling our business colleagues that we were doing licensing, they said, well, that's what we do. We license Office, we license Windows, we have all these different licenses. I said, no, it's a different type of licensing. We're licensing not products, but, you know, underlying IP and patents. So it was a very different thing. If, to be honest, the way it came about, it really started when Marshall Phelps came in from IBM, and Marshall is the one who had pretty much built the IP licensing business and patent licensing business at IBM and made it, you know, to be a powerhouse and cash cow. So he came to I think he was negotiating against Bill Gates in some deal, and Bill said, you should come to Microsoft. And, you know, he lured him away from IBM. And Marshall came, and Marshall said, you know, we need to change the way we do business here. And we're sitting on these thousands of patents and all this IP that is doing nothing. And we need to make friends. We need to have partners. We need to show we're a good player in the industry. So that kind of changed the narrative completely, very quickly, actually. It took a few months. And, you know, Marshall had this kind of honeymoon period where he could do no wrong and pretty much do almost what he wanted. So he did a lot during these months. And part of that was to build an IP licensing business. And on my end, you know, I had been, you know, the attorney leading the team that was supporting all of our Microsoft research labs around the world. We had about 1,000 PhDs around the world in 6 or 7 labs. And I was responsible for the legal team that, you know, harvested all the IP from these labs and obviously built a portfolio and then gave all the legal advice. So Marshall and I had told them that there was a lot of good stuff coming out from the labs outside and some R&D groups as well in Japan and Ireland that was kind of, you know, left to stagnate because nobody was really paying attention. So he said, well, you found the problem. Now you have to be part of the solution. So they created a new team, which was the international, you know, IP team, and eventually that led to me taking over and then taking over all the licensing of our IP. And by IP, we meant at that time two things, you know, the patent portfolio and all the unproductized technologies that were coming from our research lab, some of which were actually transferred into products, but sometimes it took years, even internally, to do the tech transfer from research to products. And a lot of these things were also amenable to different scenarios, different user cases. So for instance, you know, everybody knows Microsoft's Flight Simulator product back then that was very popular when there were very few titles. Flight Simulator was probably the most, you know, sold, you know, title in terms of people, you know, having computer games before, you know, the first consoles and all that.
Well, I remember playing it with my dad.
Yeah. It was a great product, and it was a great engine underlying that. And actually, we took the simulation engine and we licensed it out in other scenarios, in other vertical markets that had nothing to do with flight simulation. And that's just one example of something that had been productized, but, you know, could lend itself to other you know, licensing scenarios. So this is an example. We also had a bunch of really cool research code that, you know, IP and patents that we could package together. And we did actually a few what we called IP ventures. We enabled a few companies, some of which are still around, like Inrix in Seattle, which is in, you know, traffic data, was created, you know, using a lot of Microsoft IP, and then was spun out with one of our employees back then. Another company, Zumobi, which really was the pioneer that built those little tiles that used to be on someone's phone. Now, obviously, everybody, you know, all the phones, apps are based on tiles and the way all these tiles are architecture. But that was basically some technology from our Microsoft research lab in Redmond that became Zumobi, that built the apps for a lot of the large players back then. We're talking 15 years ago. So there were some IP ventures there, and then a bunch of just more discrete deals to enable partners to use some of the technology and patents from Microsoft. So we were tiptoeing into this. I mean, the other impetus is that, you know, every year we had a budget shortfall. I mean, by the time I was head of that team, we were filing about 3,300 patents a year on average. And to file all these patents and maintain all and prosecute all the other ones we had already, the budget by then, we're talking 15 years ago, was already north of $300 million a year. It was huge. So we had a shortfall of about $50, $55 million, you know, every year, and we had to make it up. And they said, well, this, you have to find the money. So either you win the lottery or you license IP So we thought the odds were a bit better licensing IP, although not that much better. But that's what we did. We had to make up for our own budget shortfall. So there was a lot of pressure, very artificial numbers, if you ask me, you know, no bearing on in reality, but you know, still we had to make that amount of money early on. So there was a real forcing function to make it work.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, obviously a lot of high-tech companies these days have huge patent portfolios, but I guess they're resistant to monetizing those portfolios, and they don't kind of they don't think about it in that way, in terms of we have to cover our own costs for growing our patent portfolio, right? It was a different kicker.
Yeah, and it has to do a lot, Eli, with the way that IP is being treated internally, financially wise. And by this I mean, if the patents belong to Corp or to the legal group which rolls into Corp, you know, it's a very different story than if they belong to the business units. And same thing for licensing. So, you know, and everyone I've ever talked that did or does my job or the job I used to have knows that the hardest thing in life is to pry patents out of a business unit when you want to sell them and monetize them. Although they belong to the company, they're a corporate asset, these business units become, they couldn't care less about patents until you tell them that you'd like to sell them. And then they become extremely territorial because, you know, it's very human nature. They say, wait a minute, if we sell or license these patents to a third party and these guys end up, you know, building a killer app that makes us look bad, we don't want to be there. We don't want to be these guys. So they will fight tooth and nail for no other reasons than pretty much avoid embarrassment against selling or licensing patents. And I now see this with clients of ours. You know, we represent Siemens, we represent Honeywell, we represent a lot of large companies. And my counterparts in those companies who are trying to monetize their portfolio are telling me it is so hard to get approval to sell or license anything because the business units don't want to let them go for no other reason that someone might succeed where they failed and they will look bad.
That's interesting. And so did you use patent brokers when you were at Microsoft? Did you too?
Well, we were courted and solicited often by patent brokers to basically help us sell our patents. So we might have worked with one or two firms, and actually this is why I became a patent broker after that, because, you know, when I did leave Microsoft in 2009, Ivy Intellectual Venture was buying patents, you know, left and right at that time. And some of those brokers contacted me because they were having a hard time getting their calls returned by the Ivy people. And they said, well, Louis, you know them, you're local. Can you help us? And that's how I kind of tiptoed into patent brokerage. Is essentially, I helped them just essentially bridge the gap and get their calls returned. And I would meet with the guys at IV locally, you know, at their offices. And that's how we got a few deals done. And eventually, I decided that, wow, I can do all these things and I can actually make money doing this. So I'll do it myself. But what's very funny though is, you know, going back to Nathan Merville and Intellectual Ventures, we were in the patent group when Nathan came and pitched the IV model to Microsoft, and they wanted Microsoft to be one of the, you know, early founders and early adopters of IV, and everybody in the patent group was very skeptical because, you know, we know what patent licensing and patent assertion is, and having an investment thesis that assumes that everybody, if you have enough patents in one area, everybody will flock to you and beg you to give them a license, we thought was just very naive, and that you would never have to sue anyone was extremely, extremely naive. But Nathan was just relentless, and he convinced Bill Gates to put his own money, personal money, and then Ben said, well, if I'm going to put some money, Microsoft has to follow on and put some money as well. So we were kind of, you know, our arms were kind of twisted to get into IV in the first place, because if you ask anyone in the patent group, we knew this business a lot better. Nobody really thought that, you know, this was necessarily going to work, at least not the way Nathan thought it was going to work. And lo and behold, when finally people came to the realization that, okay, you show me 200 patents that you think that you say I need to license, just show me the one I'm infringing and then we'll talk about it. And then the whole house of cards collapsed pretty quickly, right? Because then they had to sue. And then when they started suing, they became enemy public number one. And then the rest is history.
Yes. Yeah. So that's very interesting. I actually never heard about that, obviously, about the skepticism from the beginning, because it's in the beginning, it seemed like there was a lot of hype about them, about they're unstoppable and all that. I guess, and then it turned out
from a founder standpoint, it was a fantastic business model because they managed to create a fund, which means that when you're a fund manager, you get a carry, which is usually 2% or more over the cost or on the total money that's being committed, right? So they made a fortune just with their carry, regardless of the performance of the funds. And I think it's public knowledge that these funds did not perform really well. For a while it did, the initial investors were making money because it was a little bit of like a Ponzi scheme where, you know, as long as you find some new investor, you can repay your initial investors. So the Microsoft and the Intel and I think other large companies that invested quickly, made some money on some of the funds, but, you know, most of the later stage investors, you know, didn't make a penny or maybe broke even. But, you know, I think it's public how well or how badly these funds did. It was an interesting business model.
You mentioned the patent brokers that were approaching you for help making the right contacts and all that. So I was just wondering, who were those people in terms of what was their background? You know, I'm just curious about who were the patent brokers at the time when you joined the field. Were they former patent litigators or?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, we're going back to 2009, which was kind of the, I would say, high water of patent brokerage and patent transactions. This was, you know, the pretty much the years when, you know, Ivy was very active buying, you know, patents by the billions. You know, they spent $4 or $5 billion in acquiring patents over the years. So obviously they were buying a lot of stuff, you know, and including a lot of crap, you know, just because they had to buy by a date certain and they had to make numbers. So there was an incentive to buy, you know, regardless sometimes of the actual pedigree of the portfolios. So it was pretty easy to be a patent broker, which means that you would find almost any kind of, you know, people coming from all walks of life being brokers at that time. And they were people who were, you know, selling to Ivy and getting a commission on the buy side and on the sell side at the same time. It was just the Wild West at that time. That was, you know, before I started, you know, doing that. So those were the years of easy money, I would say. And that kind of culminated in 2012, you know, with the Nortel deal and all this, when I think we reached the apex. And then it kind of just went down the drain in 2013, you know, significantly and never really recovered. But so at that time, there were hundreds of brokers because it was so easy. And obviously, it's an unregulated profession. So anyone could, you know, hang their shingle and say, I'm a patent broker. And even today, by all measures, except today, nobody in their mind, their right mind, wants to do that because it's so hard. But in those days, it was pretty easy. So you would find a lot of people. Yes, I mean, some patent litigators or former patent litigators, but, you know, some business people, some financial people, a lot of lawyers, a lot of people with technical background, sometimes a combination thereof. It was a pretty diversified field. But, you know, I would say the common thread was people who were actively involved in IP and IP licensing, usually, or IP litigation or IP transactions. So there was always that common thread. But, you know, you had some technical, legal, and financial people, I would say, as far as their, you know, professional background.
Yes, yeah, so we'll get into a little more about, you know, we'll get into tangible IP in a minute. I had one last question about Microsoft. I guess shortly after you left, you mentioned the huge Nortel deal, which is when they sold the 4.5 their patents for $4.5 billion to a consortium involving Microsoft in 2011. But then in 2012, Microsoft acquired AOL's patents for over $1 billion. And you were actually, you mentioned what an active program Microsoft had filing and acquiring patents on their own. I guess, what did you think about that acquisition?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if you ask people who did the deal today, they would probably say they overpaid, but you could say that almost every patent transaction, you know, that was in the hundreds of millions or the billions of dollars, because patents were kind of overhyped at that time. There was a, you know, pretty high premium, and people thought they were the next kind of commercial currency to have, you know, because the legal environment was quite different than it is today. So, I mean, I don't have, you know, specific thought about that transaction. I mean, it was a big number, but, you know, they were available because of AOL, you know, obviously being sold. And so they must have thought at that time that this was filling a strategic gap. I would say most patent transactions that were in the hundreds of millions or billions ended up probably being a kind of a dog, because, you know, you can monetize so many patents in the portfolio. And, you know, the rule of thumb, as most people in the industry know, is that, you know, for every 100 patents, you probably have four or five that are really good, and the rest just comes for the ride. So it's, you know, I'm pretty sure, I'd be surprised, let's put it this way, I'd be very surprised if they recoup their investment by monetization of the portfolio itself. You know, it may have had value as a defensive weapon to deter lawsuits, or maybe it helped, you know, get better payments, incoming payments through cross-patent licensing discussions, things like that. It's very hard to calculate the ROI over these large deals, because they get sliced and diced so many different ways that, you know, nobody can really track whether it was a good deal or a bad deal 10 years later.
And you mentioned, you know, you started, you started Tangible IP, which is your brokerage firm, in 2011. That's really when you saw the peak of the, maybe the patent prices, but also the patent troll narrative. I mean, when you started it, did you expect there to be a kind of a change in, I guess, the value of patents, and I guess the patent system getting weaker and it being more difficult, I guess, to license and enforce patents?
No, if I had, I don't think I would have started this company in the first place. You know, my first full year, I really started Tangible IP at the end of 2011, after I decided to just, you know, do it by myself, as opposed to just helping other guys and then getting some crumbles of what they were making. So the business model just didn't work. And I found that I could actually source the patents myself and then do the work, you know, analysis that, you know, is needed to bring this to buyers and then sell the portfolio and negotiate all that. So my first full year was 2012, and it remains by far the best year ever for Tangible IP. So you can tell that, you know, I could have retired after 1 year and probably not be that different from where we are now. I'm exaggerating, but it was by far our best year, just because that was the last year where people were still buying patents left and right and ready to pay millions of dollars for what was, you know, a very small portfolio at that time. And if I were to sell the same portfolio today, either I would not get any offer, or it would be, you know, maybe 10, 20% of what I would have gotten 10 years ago. So very, very different landscape. And no, nobody could really see this coming. The AI with the PTAB, I think, was like a Frankenstein, you know, creation that, you know, maybe some people deviously, you know, plan for, we'll never know, but definitely I don't think anybody could predict that the PTAB would become kind of the patent death squad that, you know, we all heard about, and that it would become kind of politicized in a way that, you know, was kind of against the inventors, and that the, you know, the USPTO would become its own you know, in a sense, you know, enemy, where you know, on one end you issue patents and on the other end you essentially invalidate them, you know, by the same administration, so to speak, which is really ironic if you think about it. So I don't think anyone predicted that. I don't think anyone predicted, you know, Bielski and then obviously Alice and the carnage that it would cause to the patent landscape up to this day. Still, I think if you fast forward to today, I think the IPR system is a slightly less of a concern than it was maybe 2-3 years ago, although it's still a very big factor, but I don't think it is as acute as it used to be. And maybe it's a factor of 101 issues being even worse. So maybe they dwarf the IPR concern because of that. Not that the IPR environment is any better for patentees, but I think Alice has taken a bigger toll now just because nobody knows if patents are valid anymore, which is pretty bad to start when you're trying to transact an asset class and the very title is uncertain.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned that, you know, your first year, it seemed like it was easier, right? I'm guessing there's a lot of demand for your services and it was easy, I guess, to complete the deals. I mean, what made you, I guess, kind of stick with it afterwards, you know, up to this point, I guess, 10 years later, you know, keep doing that work?
Well, you know, I'm a very stubborn person, some around you would tell. So I guess it's probably that stubbornness that just, you know, kept me doing it. And for good or bad reasons, you know, I decided that I was going to do that. Then we found a way to do it where, you know, we could survive. And my thought was always, well, any market is cyclical by nature. So, you know, we're just going to hunker down and survive through this, you know, cycle. And then, you know, things get, you know, better again. We'll be in a really great position and with, you know, better market share and all this. So the better market share and all this turned out to be true. There are very, very few patent brokers nowadays. And we're, you know, just one of a handful left. And frankly, we get about 4 or 5 portfolios every single day that people want us to broker. And we only say yes, maybe 1 or 2% of the time. So we have no problems finding patents to sell. We have problem finding buyers to buy. And so the prediction about market share turned out to be true. The prediction about the market getting better is still unfolding. Let's put it this way.
Talk about a typical deal. Obviously, you were talking about sourcing deals. So I think when you first started out, you had to look, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the beginning, you looked for the sellers, but now I guess it seems like sellers are approaching you left and right. And then I guess, can you just walk us through a typical transaction, how that happens? Like, what motivates somebody to contact you over there?
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, I've been doing this for over 10 years, I've never actually reached out to someone and asked them if they were interested in selling their patents, you know, because I always had, well, you know, maybe I should have because others do, but we always had enough people coming to us and keeping us busy with reviewing their patents. And we knew they were willing to sell. So, you know, convincing someone to sell, as I found out, representing buyers is very hard sometimes. As much as there's an oversupply of patent and very little demand, you know, when you actually have demand and you know which patent they want to buy, it just so happens that these guys never want to sell. So it's really hard to make the match. But turning to what you said, I mean, a typical sale, I mean, normally someone will come to us, say, okay, we'd like to monetize our patents. So, you know, we do have an intake process where, you know, obviously we have a bunch of questions to ask them about not only the patents, but the reasons for the sale, past efforts that they may have made. Because, you know, very often they don't tell you, but they come to you after they've tried other things. Sometimes they put people on notice, or sometimes they use another broker, or sometimes they try to sell themselves. And if they shop the patents around extensively, they're, you know, it's too late. You know, they're kind of burned the assets in the market, and we're not going to be interested in taking over. But, you know, obviously, when we look at patents, the very first thing we look is, are these patents being infringed by anyone? I mean, this is what trumps everything else. If there's no evidence of use that anyone is practicing these patents, you know, I can always predict with 100% certainty that they will not sell. You know, it's like me trying to sell you an auto insurance policy with the best premium, the lowest premium, the best coverage, and you just don't own a car. You don't need that. And it's a problem with patents. People don't understand is that unless someone is infringing or is about to, or one of their competitors is, they're not going to be interested in purchasing this, because the only reason it would purchase this is to you know, take care of a business risk on their end, or to monetize, or having a strategic advantage, or to monetize the assertion value. So we really focus hard on the assertion potential first, which is really a legal and technical analysis, you know, in terms of, you know, can we create some litigation grade claim charts, you know, with these patents. And then we look at validity, of course, you know, especially given, you know, priority issues, you know, 101 issues, all kind of other issues. Then we have to look a little bit at, okay, who would be the targets, you know, and what kind of damages are we talking about? You know, if the damages are $1 million, nobody's going to buy this if it costs them $5 million to litigate. Because, you know, a lot of the buyers will be non-practicing entities, which is new. I mean, it used to be that most buyers were operating companies. Again, you go back 10 years ago, 7 years ago, people were still in kind of portfolio building mode. You had a lot of Chinese companies that were trying to go a little bit more globally and were fairly naked, patent-wise, fairly vulnerable in Europe and the US, and they were looking to acquire patents. So they would be our more regular buyers, you know, along with IV at that time. But then, you know, with Alice and all that, it pretty much changed completely. And nowadays, most of the buyers are non-practicing entities. Not exclusively, but, you know, I would say a large percentage of our deals these days are with non-practicing entities. Not that we wouldn't love to sell or license to operating companies, but they're just not interested. And they're fine being sued, apparently. You know, they don't care. Because a lot of the portfolios that we couldn't sell are now being asserted by the owners directly in court. And sometimes the same parties that had a chance to buy or license these patents for a song, you know, 2-3 years ago, now have to pony up a lot more money to defend or to get a license. But it's part of their business model to do it that way.
And do you think, like, the people making those decisions within the operating companies are kind of starting to learn that lesson that maybe it's...
No. To be honest, no. And, you know, I come from the corporate world. Here's a little dirty secret that people should know about that explains a lot of the behavior. So if, let's say that, you know, my old employer, Microsoft, is alleged to be infringing patent X, you know, and I'm the owner of patent X. I'm going to, you know, tell them, you guys infringe my patent or my patents. You should take a license. So they will review this, and they might actually be of the same opinion that this looks bad. You know, this looks like we're infringing, and they're going to turn around and they're going to tell the business unit that owns the infringing product, if you will, hey guys, we have this claim from a third party patent owner. We think it's legit. We think we should negotiate with them a license fee. So that, you know, there's no risk of enjoining. The product is pretty low these days, but at least, you know, there's no risk of having an adverse judgment, you know, 5-10 years from now in the gazillion dollars. So the business unit will say, where is the money coming from? Well, from you, you know, business unit, from your P&L. Then the business unit will say, well, then we're not interested. You know, wait to see if they're going to sue. Because the business units and most companies know really well that if they license pre-litigation, it's coming out of their P&L. So it makes them look less profitable when they roll up the numbers. Whereas if they wait until they get sued and then the litigation group takes over and then there's a settlement 2-3 years later, then it's corporate money. It's not against their P&L. It's coming out of corp. And because of that, there's absolutely no incentive in large corporations who are set up that way, and most of them are, to do any pre-litigation licensing, because the person writing the check can pass the buck to someone else who's going to write a check later on, and it's not going to impact their P&L. So if we just change that rule, I can tell you it would change overnight the face of patent licensing. I can predict that.
You know, is there anything, I guess, and going back to the sellers that approach you, I mean, do those sellers already know who might be infringing their patents, or is it a lot of times you're kind of, let's say a seller comes and says, you know, and maybe you could give an example of like, is it a company that's going through financial hardships? What is, I guess, a typical?
There's more than one typical type of interaction, but you know, one category is what we call the crazy inventor who designed something, you know, a better cap for a soda can, let's put it this way, and they have one provisional patent file and they say everybody is infringing my provisional patent that I want $5 billion plus 10%, you know. So you have those guys. Those are among the 99% that we reject just because, you know, first they don't have any rights, or even if they have any issued patents, you know, we'll never be able to work with them in a way that makes them happy, because they will always feel like someone is trying to screw them. And so it's very hard to work with individual inventors, unfortunately, although, you know, I love their inventions and their contribution, but, you know, very often their expectations are such that, you know, it's really, really hard to agree on something that they would find realistic given today's market. And they don't have a good view of the market. You know, they read some headlines from time to time, and the only thing that makes the headline is, you know, the $1 billion award. So they always think it's their case, and it's their turn to get that. So you have that. You have,
taking into account that Federal Circuit is likely to overturn that verdict as well, right?
Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, we always hear about the initial verdict, not the overturn. At least it doesn't make the headline. So, you know, it's like that, you know, I'm sure you remember that lawsuit 20, 25 years ago when someone sued McDonald's because she dropped coffee on her lap. And she was awarded millions of dollars. And after that, McDonald's had to put a warning on the cup, you know, warning this water is hot, to disclaim liability. But, you know, nobody remembered that the decision was overturned and the damages were pretty much quashed to almost nothing. But going back to what you said, so the second, I would say, more regular user case scenario is, yeah, kind of the failed startup, you know, companies that have invested a lot in R&D and building a small, you know, niche patent portfolio, and they ran out of money because, you know, either they were not really good at executing on it, or they just didn't pick up commercially because they were too early or too late. And so we have a lot of those, and those are usually quite interesting from the sense that, you know, they were pioneers in their field, normally if it's a startup. So the patent, the group of patent they may have is usually a very good quality as far as the disclosures are. Unfortunately, very often the prosecution kind of, you know, ruined the sauce here, because, you know, you have bad claim language, too many limitations, they forgot to file continuations to keep families open, things like that. So just bad strategy, but great idea. So if there's an open continuation sometimes and we have a great spec, we might actually take the portfolio on the brokerage, and then our patent attorneys will work with the prosecuting firm trying to, you know, steer the boat back in the right direction and get some better claims that are enforceable and kind of clean some of the mess they created. So we have that. And then we have, I would say, the large corporation that I mentioned. We represent Siemens, Honeywell, we represent, you know, or represent Google, HP, Orange Telecom, Carrier, other companies that, you know, we represent on the buy side that I can't name. But, you know, these large corporations obviously are very sophisticated. They know what it is to license or monetize their patents. Most of them have a very robust licensing group. They just don't know how to sell patents. And that's not, well, and when they try, they usually fail. So, you know, they'd all end up turning around and coming to see us and asking us for help. And so we do this, and, you know, we've been relatively successful selling some of their portfolios as well.
Well, you know, I want to get to the ecosystem because I think that's a very interesting aspect of that. But I guess, you know, imagine there's this general counsel of a startup listening to this, and he says, I want to make sure that the patent portfolio we are building is in that litigation grade shape that Louis is talking about in terms of, you know, having strong patents. I mean, what advice? I mean, I think you touched upon some of it. Obviously, you know, cutting edge technology, having strong specification, you know, keeping alive through continuations. But what other advice, I guess, in terms of like good prosecution practice that I guess you would advise?
No, you're right. I mean, as you know, patent prosecution is part art, part science, and you can have a great invention and a very bad patent at the end because it wasn't done properly, which is a shame. And a lot of companies, most inventors don't have the sophistication to understand whether what they have in their hand is actually an enforceable patent or not. So we do have, and I'm not going to repeat everything that's there, but on our website, we do have a little article about what makes patents valuable. And that is kind of, you know, the best practices I can share. You know, they're all there. So if you go to tangibleip.biz, you'll find that. But at a high level, yeah, obviously we mentioned the continuation, that this is something that is very specific to the US, but obviously since it's, you know, the most vibrant market worldwide, it's pretty important to address it. So when we see that people, you know, just to spare some money, did not keep a family open, we always, you know, say, oh, too bad, you know, we could have fixed this, but now there's no continuation. So either you have to file a re-exam or, you know, you could always amend if there's an IPR, but, you know, you're in a pretty high risk territory whereas if there's an open continuation, it's so easy. You just change the claim. Same thing with the lack of prior art searches. You know, there's still a lot of prosecuting attorneys who will tell their clients, you know, don't pay for a prior art search. You know, the examiner will do it and it's free, right? Technically, it's true, except that, you know, they know better than that. They know that the examiner will never find all the relevant prior art. They know that on average, a U.S. examiner, even if the prosecution lasts 3 years, we'll only spend maybe 2.5 hours on prior art searches and only look into the U.S. database. So the, you know, the patent that issues where all the prior art is cited by the examiner, I can guarantee you is 90% likely to be invalidated if it's ever challenged. There's a little bit of a, I think, kind of cognitive dissonance between the business model of patent law firms and the reality of the market. So the first thing is prior art search. The second thing is continuation. The third thing is I would always tell people to file a PCT and try to get at least, you know, one patent in Europe and you know, maybe one in China, depending on what technology is involved. You know, you don't have to go in 25 countries, but at least hit a few more than just the U.S. You know, it used to be that if you cornered the U.S. market, that was more than enough. That's no longer the case. There's a domestic, you know, market in China now and in Europe where, and sometimes there's, because of the products being sold globally, there's a lot of, you know, strategic advantage of having a patent in Germany, for instance, or a patent in China for something that's being manufactured in China, for instance, where you can get an injunctive relief, or sold in Europe where you can get, again, an injunction in Germany. So there's some strategic advantage of doing that. But also it's just the, you know, having enforceable claims. A lot of times people still draft claims to protect the invention and not to protect the design around and not to think about, okay, how will my competitors think? And so they're, you know, very narrow, and they put some limitation that they didn't have to put. And they, you know, we just end up with patents where, yeah, technically the product is doing everything the specification describes, but, you know, that's not the way the claims were drafted, and they're just too narrow. Or you have some divided infringement issue very often that we see, or some indefiniteness. So there's still a lot of mistakes made by people who draft patents, and I just wish there were better tools to catch those. and fix those. Because, you know, when we look at these patents, we all we can do is bang our head on the wall and say, oh, shoot, this is so bad. You know, why did they do it that way? I have my guy, my patent attorney calling me every day and said, I've just looked at so-and-so's patents and why on earth did they do it this way? Or why did they say this? They didn't have to. Or why did they have this limitation in the claim? They didn't have to, you know. But not everybody has his experience and acumen. So it's those are the things that jump to me. And unfortunately, there are more patents like this that have these flaws than not. And that explains why, you know, although we have so many people wanting to sell, and we do have a lot of buyers wanting to buy. I represent four or five different buyers now that are actively needing patents. They just can't find one they like. You know, they're looking for a patent that obviously is quasi-perfect. And there are very few of those because most of them have flaws.
And these are patent assertion entities or, yeah.
Operating companies.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, all operating companies, you know, needing some patents in specific areas for whatever reasons they have. And they just can't find them. We show them hundreds of patents and they just can't find one they like enough because every time they look under the hood, they find some flaws. Prior art, you know, claim drafting issues, close families, you know, no counterparts, some, you know, indefiniteness or divided infringement issues, or just, you know, no way to calculate damages the way the claim was drafted because it's either a method claim when it should have been a product claim or vice versa. I mean, it runs the gamut, but, you know, it's hard to find the patent everybody likes.
And are these, I guess, operating companies that are facing litigation and they're looking for
not
some defense?
Not necessarily. Okay. I mean, some might. And again, they don't always share the reasons why they're looking for something. And frankly, we don't pry. We're just happy to help them. And sometimes it helps to know the context. Sometimes they are expecting a litigation and they want to be preemptive by securing assets that read on the company on the other side. Sometimes they just want to have stuff on their competitors or they're entering into a new area and they want to make sure they have something inorganically that quickly helps them build their portfolio because it might take them 10, 12 years organically to get there. So there's, you know, various reasons, good reasons to wanting to buy patents. The problem is, you know, it's unlike real estate where you always end up finding the right house because if it's not perfect, you just lower the price. With patents, it's not really price related. Obviously, there is a price component, but it, you know, regardless of the price, you know, some people will not even want to acquire patents for free if they don't like the patents, because then they have to start paying for maintenance fees and prosecution fees if they're still open and all this. It's like a free puppy, you know? It's only free for a few hours, and after that you start paying. So patents are the price elasticity for patent is really different than for most goods. It's really about the pedigree itself. There's so much uncertainty about, you know, title. And obviously, 101 is a big issue. I mean, I should have mentioned that. You know, that's the first thing that buyers say, you know, we like the patent, but the 101 risk is too high. Or you talk to litigators and they say, you know, we can't take this on a contingency basis for your client because the 101 risk is too high. Or funding entities will say, we won't fund something if there's a 101 risk. Come back to us after maybe you survive a 101 motion if there's one. So it's that those are the big impediments.
I want to discuss the ecosystems about the patent assertion entities, which you mentioned are, you know, these days the very frequently the buyers. I mean, I think you see a dual track of both the rise or maybe revival of patent assertion entities and litigation funding. So I guess one thing that I'm interested in, you know, there seems like a lot of division of labor, right? There's a patent owner out there. There's a brokers. There's a patent assertion entity. Then there's litigation funders. A lot of things are like that. But why do you think it's broken down in that way? I guess why don't the patent assertion entities do the fund litigation funding? Why is there such a division of labor?
Well, I mean, the ecosystem has always had the same players, more or less. You know, operating companies, you know, patent assertion entities or NPEs, defensive aggregators like the RPX or AST or, you know, OIM and others, OIM being the Open Innovation Network. So I would say the mix of players hasn't changed. What has changed over the past years is who's most active. I mean, I would say the only additional player in the last decade has been, you know, the growth and resurgence of patent funding entities who play kind of the sideline. But because they have a much bigger role now, they have obviously given a second wind to a lot of NPEs that now have the ability to fund either an acquisition or more often fund a more robust campaign. So that has brought, you know, more litigation as a result. But, you know, the operating companies, you know, used to be the main buyers, and because they have retreated and, you know, hardly buying anything, you know, there's a vacuum, you know, so the assets are still there for sale and there's a vacuum of buyers. So because the funding entities now allow NPEs to have a way to to fund their campaigns, they can afford to acquire more patents, knowing that, you know, they will have some funding available for good ones in their respective campaigns. So I think it's a really, it's a combination of both. You know, I don't think the NPs would be as active if they didn't have all this funding available. And there has been quite a lot of money coming into the IP sphere in the past 5-10 years that wasn't there before. You know, Ivy used to play that role in terms of, you know, pumping the market. When Ivy stopped buying, there was really, I would say, a lull for a few years, and then funding entities started, you know, being more active. You know, but again, you know what it is in the patent market, you lose more than you win. So they have to choose their cases very selectively, and their business terms are fairly onerous because they represent a pretty high risk of not being successful and a very expensive path to know the response to your question, am I going to win this? So if it's going to cost you $3 to $5 million to sue a Samsung or an Apple because they're going to fight tooth and nail and not settle, and you only win one time out of three, one time out of four, even though the amount might be fairly large and there's a high risk it might be reduced later, you have to factor all that in, you know. So because of that, you know, most patents will not get funding, and as a result, most NPs will not buy them. Then there's another class of NPEs that will do, I would say, high volume, low cost type of campaign and assertion. So if you have patents maybe of a lower pedigree that still need to be fairly good, but may not be the ones that you want to go against, you know, a Fortune 50 company up to the Supreme Court, you know, there might still be some interest from some NPEs to buy them, usually at no cash or very low cash up front, and then just have a revenue sharing with the seller, and then go after a bunch of smaller companies and do a slew of, you know, settlements, you know, sub 100 case settlements, you know, and still have a fairly, you know, successful campaign. If you didn't pay a penny, anything is a profit, right? And if you share the profit, you know, at the end of the day, you know, nobody makes a ton of money, but, you know, at least the inventors feel somehow vindicated that someone had to pay for their invention that was infringed, you know, broadly by the industry. So, you know, there's a bit of everything.
So just to close the loop on that, so I guess in that typical transaction, you know, you get a seller, you vet their patents, you come up with these litigation grade claim charts, you think that they have some pretty strong assets at that point, and I guess the typical buyers are the patent assertion entities, and I guess you bring it to them. Is there, like, based on how strong the patent asset is, based on how much damages are involved, you go to a specific patent assertion entity to make that sale? Or is it kind of an auction process where the multiple patent assertion entities kind of look at those assets, really high quality assets, and then they all kind of give their value? But
yeah, again, it kind of depends. It's a little bit of both. I mean, if we know, I mean, we have a database of, what, 75 pages of buyer's interest that, you know, we keep up to date. You know, we talk to buyers all the time. Our BP brokerage is on phone with buyers day in, day out. So we have a very extensive confidential list of what they're looking for. So if we have something that fits that, we're going to show it to them first as a courtesy for them sharing their wish list, if you will. So we'll do that. We'll kind of give them an early preview because we know they're looking into this, and that's the reason why we wanted to have their wish list in the first place. And then, depending on the type of portfolio, yeah, I mean, we're not going to show the same portfolio to an Acacia that we would show to another NP that does more volume, low-end assertion. You know, depending on what we think the price is, or if the client is not willing to do a revenue share, or they want an all-cash sale, and they're not interested into anything hybrid, then it rules out a lot of smaller NPs, and then we'll just show it to a few well-funded NPs that we know are buying cash. Doesn't mean they will be interested in buying, but at least we know the other ones won't have something that the client would want to live with. So that dictates I would say the pedigree of the portfolio and the client's requirements dictate who we talk to, and also obviously depending on who's looking for what, we will reach out to these first.
So final question is, let's say there's a young lawyer out there who's listening to this. Maybe he's a patent attorney, and he goes, "No, this being a broker sounds very exciting, you know, making these deals happen." What advice would you give them about becoming the next Louis Carboneau?
I would tell him, run away and never come back. Like Simba in The Lion King, right? Frankly, I always joke, you know, if you want to become a millionaire, you start as a billionaire and you become a patent broker. So it's, to be honest, it's a very, very tough environment. And I don't say that to get rid of new competitors. I would embrace them dearly, but it's such a tough environment. And unless everybody knows you, which I think is one of our attributes, you know, it's going to be hard for you to find someone who wants to retain you, because, you know, people want to work with the more, you know, established firms, and they're very, very few. But also, you know, it's so hard to monetize patents. I mean, the reality is, I look at our revenues this year from last year, from 2 years ago, you know, not that it's going down, it's going up, but we have to reinvent ourselves each year. Most of our revenues this year will come from portfolios that have been sold in the past for no cash and are being asserted. And what we're getting now is our commission based on the deferred revenue. And we also do a ton of licensing. You know, we are very active in licensing portfolios, voluntary licensing. We don't do any, you know, threat or assertion based licensing, but a lot of licensing through defensive aggregators who represent members and all this. And that's a big part of our business now, so which wasn't there at all even a year ago. And obviously the assertion revenues are stuff that, you know, seeds that we planted 3-4 years ago. So if we only lived on the deals we closed, like the straight sale, we wouldn't have enough to eat probably this year. But because we've planted these seeds over the years and we have other, you know, programs, we managed to do fairly well, and we have very, very little overhead. This is a cutthroat business where you can't afford to have overhead. So it's you basically eat what you kill. It's not for the faint of heart. So I would tell a young attorney, you know, if you have a real job with a law firm, keep it for now and wait until Alice is gone and IPRs are gone and the patent market comes back, and then you'll have, you know, a baker's dozen of new brokers, you know, sprouting out, because it will be easy to do this. But currently it's a really tough profession, and that's why there's so few of us left.
Well, that's hard to hear from that young attorney, but it's very good practical advice. All right, thank you so much, Louis, for joining. I really appreciate you doing this.
It was my pleasure, Eli. Great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.